It's Tuesday, June 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States and China hold very direct talks.
Now we have even more stealing of very sensitive information this time. So this is an issue that I think is really very high on the U.S. agenda.
The United Nations opens a human rights office in the South Korean capital to investigate North Korea, and a new documentary shows a young patient's battle against disease with some help from the Make-A-Wish Foundation. It's all ahead. This week, the United States and China are taking part in their seventh strategic and economic dialogue. The cabinet-level discussions in Washington involve hundreds of diplomats from both countries and are being hosted by Secretary of State John Kerry and Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. John Kirby is a State Department spokesman.
We are looking to expand our bilateral cooperation on many global challenges such as climate change, development, humanitarian assistance, pandemic response, and ocean conservation. We'll also have the chance to coordinate U.S. and Chinese policies on regional issues like Iran, Iraq, and Syria, North Korea, and Afghanistan. And we will also address areas where we have ongoing differences, such as maritime disputes, cybersecurity, and human rights. As we have said many times, the United States is firmly committed to improving its relationship with China.
He says while the countries disagree on many points, including cybersecurity and maritime disputes, they recognize there are many areas for mutually beneficial cooperation. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Centers for Strategic and International Studies China scholar Bonnie Glaser. She says the dialogue is split among 3 days of discussions on security, economic, and strategic matters. And she says this round of the talks has taken on special significance as it comes ahead of the planned state visit to Washington by Chinese President Xi Jinping.
China is trying to signal the United States that it wants to lower tensions, at least temporarily, in the run-up to Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to the United States in September. And he will, of course, be hosted this time for a state visit. It's very important, I think, to China and also to the United States. The U.S. would like the visit to go well. So China has announced that it is nearing completion of the building of artificial islands in the Spratlys. But the United States hasn't received that message very well because the U.S. is worried about the militarization of those islands. And indeed, the Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, at the Shangri-La Dialogue, called for an end to further militarization of these islands by all of the claimants. So far, China has not been willing to put a cap on what it plans to deploy. But that conversation is ongoing, and perhaps they will make some headway.
Bonnie, the State Department spokesman said on Monday the U.S. is firmly committed to improving its relationship with China. But on the matter of this apparent widespread hacking of the Office of Personnel Management involving millions of former and current federal workers, there was some evidence that suggested it may have emanated from China. Where do we stand between the two countries on the matter of cybersecurity?
Well, Danny Russell, the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia, did make clear that this is a topic that will be raised in all three of these dialogue mechanisms over the next 3 days. This is of great concern to the United States. Of course, in the past, the United States has been concerned about China's use of cyber to steal intellectual property. That issue has not gone away, and now we have even more stealing of very sensitive information this time. So this is an issue that I think is really very high on the U.S. agenda. Of course, it is alleged. I would imagine that the Chinese are going to want to see proof of attribution. I don't know whether the United States is willing to share sources and methods on that issue. But I think the U.S. is going to try and convey to China that if it has done this, it has overstepped the boundaries of what is acceptable. One of the challenges we face is that there used to be a bilateral dialogue mechanism that was dedicated to the discussion of cyber matters. China suspended that when the United States charged five military officers with some cyber hacking. And the Chinese suspended that dialogue mechanism. And so far, China's still not willing to reinvigorate it and reconvene.
And you would characterize bilateral relations today as perhaps complex?
I think it's fair to say that the U.S.-China bilateral relationship is quite complicated. It is, I think, unreasonable to say that it has reached a tipping point, that something new is going on, that the relationship is fated to go in a negative direction. I think we have wise leaders in both the United States and China. We have vast people-to-people exchanges, economic interdependence, and we understand that there is a need to get along and to manage our differences where we do disagree. And, of course, the United States even sometimes disagrees with allies. So I think there's every reason to believe that the United States and China can manage the differences going forward, and that the policy essentially of engagement that has been pursued under 8 presidents in the United States is still the right policy for the United States.
That's Bonnie Glaser of the Centers for Strategic and International Studies. Well, meanwhile, Deputy U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Work on Monday warned China is posing a serious challenge to U.S. military superiority in air and space. Speaking to the China Aerospace Studies Initiative, involving members of the U.S. Air Force and the RAND Corporation think tank, Work said Beijing is quickly closing the technological gaps in developing radar-evading aircraft, advanced reconnaissance planes, sophisticated missiles, and electronic warfare equipment. Bonnie Glaser says there's no question that the militaries of the two countries are in a growing competition. She says China's goal is to keep the U.S. away from its near-seas borders during a potential regional crisis. She says that is counter to U.S. obligations to regional allies. Glaser says this is a growing and long-term problem that will not necessarily lead to war, but must be part of an ongoing dialogue. U.S. President Barack Obama spoke out against religious prejudice Monday at a White House dinner celebrating the start of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Several members of the diplomatic community, lawmakers, and Muslim Americans were on hand for a traditional iftar dinner, which follows daily fasting from dawn to sunset. Mr. Obama said the iftar dinner is a reminder of the freedoms that bind us together as Americans, including the inviolable right to practice our faith freely. He condemned a number of recent deadly incidents involving religion, including last week's mass shooting at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina.
As Americans, we insist that nobody should be targeted because of who they are or what they look like, who they love, how they worship. We stand united against these hateful acts.
Mr. Obama also recognized the refugee crisis triggered by the ongoing violent uprisings in the Middle East, as well as the plight of Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims escaping persecution in their own country. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending today. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, you heard President Obama there speaking about the shooting at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston that killed 9 this past Wednesday, and that's been the topic that's been dominating social media over the past few days. What we see now is that the conversation has shifted from the victims and the shooter to now what's going to come out of this. And the hashtag that's coming out of this is hashtag take down the flag. Now, many of us here in the U.S. know the South has a very complicated history with the Confederate flag. The South had split off from the North during the Civil War, and in South Carolina at the State House, they still fly this Confederate flag. It's also used as a symbol that has a lot of racial connotations, and it was used in the South during the 50s and 60s as kind of a Southern pride and as a racist symbol. So people are saying now that they should take down this flag from outside the South Carolina State House, and it's been used throughout the internet, this hashtag take down the flag. A petition online is calling for the flag to be removed from all government places. It's received more than 500,000 signatures. And people sending out political cartoons talking about how ridiculous it is that this flag is still up in the wake of this shooting and in the year, the time where we live in now. It's been so many years since the Civil War. So that's a hot trending topic, and that's where the conversation has gone in that story. We're also seeing, sadly, this morning that James Horner, he's an Academy Award-winning composer, he reportedly died yesterday in a small plane crash in California. Now, you may not know his name, but you definitely know his music. He wrote the music for Braveheart, Apollo 13, won 2 Oscars for James Cameron's Titanic, including for the song My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. Wrote the music for Avatar. So he's a titan in music in Hollywood and being missed, being remembered by celebrities across the internet this morning. Director and actor Ron Howard tweeting out his condolences. Actor Russell Crowe, who worked with him on several films, also tweeting out his. And finally, the other top trending hashtag this morning, hashtag Paris 2024. Paris has just announced that it is going to put in a bid for the 2024 Summer Olympic Games. It will be, in 2024, the 100th anniversary of Paris, the last time they hosted the Games. People are taking to Twitter, and it's interesting, people are taking to Twitter even in the U.S. and saying, Paris is a pretty good choice. I think Paris would be a great host for the Games. Interestingly, though, the U.S. is bidding and has the U.S. city of Boston that's bidding. So people in the U.S. already, I think, ditching that bid and saying Paris should get it.
Yeah, Paris versus Boston. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
And we have Rome and Hamburg, Germany as well. So those four cities duking it out.
A couple of other selections. Okay, Well, thank you, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Polshevsky, and this is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Drought, record flooding, and deadly heat waves. A recent study in the journal Nature Climate Change says extreme weather is becoming more frequent and links it to a rise in greenhouse gas emissions. The report says such weather events have more than doubled in the past three decades. Harold Brooks is with the National Weather Center.
The heat wave, particularly the one in Europe in the early 2000s and the one in Russia, a couple of years ago, almost certainly had their probabilities increased dramatically because of greenhouse gas emissions.
Brooks says, however, the world will continue to experience extreme weather no matter what happens with greenhouse gas emissions.
The really interesting question is, what we try to actually answer is, has the increase in greenhouse gases change the probability of an event occurring?
Brooks says, in general, weather watchers expect to see an increase in both floods and droughts associated with greenhouse gas emissions. I'm VOA's Rebecca Ward for Greenbeat.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, one young leukemia patient's battle against his disease becomes a documentary. The United Nations officially opened a new field office in Seoul today to document human rights abuses in North Korea. VOA's Brian Padden reports the world body has been trying to increase pressure on the repressive Kim Jong-un regime to end ongoing systematic human rights violations that it calls without parallel in the contemporary world.
Phil Robertson with the non-government group Human Rights Watch calls the opening of the UN's field office in Seoul a critical step forward in the campaign to hold North Korea's leaders accountable for committing crimes against humanity.
This is something that Kim Jong-un should be staying awake at night thinking about, because he is going to be facing a determined team of professional investigators looking and speaking to people to find out the abuses that are taking place against them.
International pressure has been intensifying on Pyongyang since the release of a UN report last year documenting a network of political prisons in North Korea holding 120,000 people and a list of atrocities that include murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, and rape. The UN General Assembly overwhelmingly passed a resolution to refer Pyongyang to the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, but the process was stalled in the UN Security Council. It has not been brought to a vote there because it is believed that North Korea's allies, China and Russia, would veto any punitive action. Investigators working in the UN Human Rights Field Office in Seoul will document further atrocities and cases of abuse inside the North for possible legal action in the future. Human Rights Watch's Robertson says North Korean officials at the UN initially offered to cooperate in exchange for immunity.
They also insisted that certain things be granted as concessions up front to North Korea, that there be no reference to any sort of leadership accountability. And, you know, the international community and human rights systems don't work that way.
Since then, North Korea has responded to human rights criticisms with strong denials, threats of retaliation, and further isolation. This week, Pyongyang said it would boycott next month's World University Games in South Korea to protest the opening of the UN Human Rights Office in Seoul. Choi Young-sung with the Network for North Korean Democracy and Human Rights says it is important to clarify that the UN office in Seoul is looking into abuses by the leadership and is not targeting the people of North Korea. Choi says the purpose of the activities of the office is to observe Kim Jong-un and other top members who suppress North Koreans' human rights. They should know, he says, that the activities of the office are not to suppress or isolate North Koreans. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry recently said North Korea has also alienated its allies Russia and China by rejecting overtures to restart talks to end Pyongyang's nuclear program in exchange for increased aid and development assistance. In 2013, the United Nations imposed harsh sanctions on the regime after North Korea conducted its third nuclear test. International food aid, especially from South Korea and the United States, has also been drastically cut. At the same time, the UN is trying to pressure the Kim Jong-un regime to curb human rights abuses. The UN World Food Program is appealing for over $100 million in food aid for North Korea. The North is suffering through a severe drought that could cause significant food shortages for millions of Koreans. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
There's a new film out about an effort to help a child battle a deadly disease. VOA's David Byrd joins us in the studio to tell us more.
Miles Scott is just this cute little kid. He loves comics. He loves Batman. And so much so that when he was diagnosed with leukemia, his wish was to play a kid version of Batman in a movie. You see in the film, Patricia Wilson, who's the executive director of the Greater Bay Area Make-A-Wish Foundation, talk about what happened next. It was beyond something that anybody in her office could have imagined.
When we're going about doing a wish, it is whimsical and thinking about what would wow that child. So we decided to turn San Francisco into Gotham City and have him have these capers for the full-size grown-up Batman so that he'd have a buddy. One of our volunteers put into Facebook and Twitter, and like wildfire, just like it exploded.
Mike Jutan was the volunteer that put out the original social media communications. Eventually, his tweets and Facebook postings reached 2 billion people around the world. Now, they had the premiere of Bat Kid Begins in Los Angeles, and at that premiere, Jutan said that he never expected that kind of response.
So I was, they say anyway, as the legend goes, the legend of Bat Kid, one of my initial tweets was the one that kind of started this whole process rolling and resulted in 2 billion people worldwide seeing this and 25,000 people showing up in San Francisco. Absolutely crazy. Something much bigger than we ever expected.
Director Dana Nachman turned Miles' story into this documentary. And in this, San Francisco is turned into Gotham City. Fans will remember that Gotham City is where Batman lives, complete with Batman's villainous rivals, including the Riddler and the Penguin. Now, what happens is Miles and his full-size Batman sidekick, who was also in the full black Batman costume, were able to capture the villains and save the day with real crowds of people, people who had heard Miles' story and were cheering him on, including U.S. President Barack Obama by video.
Every actor that ever played Batman was tweeting, Adam West on line one. Okay, that's normal.
Let me out!
No!
Way to go, Miles. Way to save Gotham.
Believe it or not, they're dancing for you.
Now, I mentioned the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Patricia Wilson is the Greater Bay Area Executive Director for that group. And she says that while Miles' story hasn't resulted in more heroic requests, people wanting to be a superhero, it has drawn attention to the work that Make-A-Wish does.
Okay, so the requests haven't been more outrageous, but we have 40% more increase in wishes just for my chapter. And so Bree is here from the LA chapter. We're all seeing an increase, which is beautiful. We've also had an increase in revenue, but it's not keeping pace, so I do have one huge regret. I regret that I didn't have Miles really rob a bank, because I think we could have gotten away with it, and I'd never need to fundraise for Make-A-Wish again.
Miles Scott, because he's only about six, did not attend the premiere in Los Angeles, but director Dana Nachman said that he is doing better, actually. He's in remission from leukemia, and he's looking forward to having a great summer.
So Miles is in remission. He's a great little boy. He just finished first grade, lost his tooth, played Little League, basically ready for a really fun, low-key summer, and they're awesome. Couldn't be happier.
This film, Bat Kid Begins, has been making the film festival rounds since January. It starts limited release in the United States this month, and it'll have expanded release in July. And all the proceeds from Bat Kid Begins go to the Bat Kid Fund, which benefits San Francisco area charities.
That's David Byrne, and that's our show. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terrorist group Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIL or Daesh, has been engaged in the destruction and theft of some of the world's most important heritage sites and antiquities, dating back thousands of years. In late May, ISIL occupied the town of Tadmor, Syria, and the huge ruins of one of the great sites of the ancient world, the classical city of Palmyra. As part of its violent rampage through Syria and Iraq, ISIL has targeted for demolition sites of religious and cultural significance. Propaganda videos produced by the group depict its followers blowing up an ancient Assyrian palace at Nimrud, smashing statues at the Mosul Museum, and destroying the Mosque of Nebi Yunus, which housed the tomb of Jonah, a place sacred to Muslims, Christians, and Jews. They are destroying and looting irreplaceable cultural property in order to intimidate and humiliate populations, and looted artifacts have become a significant source of income for terrorist groups, wrote Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs Sheba Crocker in a recent blog post. This is not just a cultural tragedy, said UNESCO's Director General Irina Bokova. It's also a security issue, with terrorists using the destruction of heritage as a weapon of war, an instrument of propaganda and destabilization, and as a means of financing their operations. The United States strongly supports UNSC Resolution 2199, which condemns the wanton destruction of cultural heritage in Iraq and Syria. It also reaffirms an existing ban on the sale of Iraqi antiquities illegally removed from the country and requires all member states to take additional appropriate steps to prohibit the smuggling of Syrian antiquities. Along these lines, the U.S. State Department recently funded the reissue of the Emergency Red List of Iraqi Cultural Objects at Risk to alert the public to types of antiquities most at risk of smuggling and trafficking, and co-hosted with UNESCO a roundtable discussion on this issue moderated by Assistant Secretary of State Evan Ryan. We also call on all UN member nations to start enforcing UNESCO's 1970 flagship convention aimed at prohibiting the illicit trade in cultural property. 128 of the 195 member states have signed the convention, but only some, like the U.S., Switzerland, and U.K., implement it through national legislation. The United States and UNESCO are leading the efforts to protect antiquities, monuments, and sites that hold universal value for mankind, wrote Assistant Secretary Crocker. For both the United States and the U.N., preserving diverse cultural heritage is a critical step toward reconstruction, reconciliation, and building civil society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.